For our World Cafe Sense of Place visit to Nashville, we had a chance to talk with two longtime residents, Gillian Welch and David Rawlings, about their time there. Gillian's records are standouts of alt country. The two put out their first disc, Revival, in 1996, and in 2011 they put out The Harrow and The Harvest. Gil and Dave recently bought the legendary Woodland Studios in Nashville to set up shop. Since they had been there for over 20 years, I started out asking Gillian about how the pair first ended up in Nashville in the early 1990s after meeting at the Berklee School of Music in Boston.
We moved there a little over 20 years ago. It was the summer of 92. We both moved from Boston, and it was obviously, you know, for the music. I think I moved a month before Dave. I had a tiny head start on him. My story was, you know, I at that point knew I wanted to be a songwriter, and knew that I wanted to be in a city, you know, that was known for that. So I was kind of looking at Los Angeles, New York, and Nashville, and Nashville was the obvious choice for me because of the kind of music that came out of there.
Now, when did you have people you know who kind of helped you out at the beginning?
Yeah, that was one of the great things about Nashville was, you know, well, and still is true, is Southern hospitality is real, you know, and there were the first person who really helped me out was a woman named Lee Satterfield, who was a fellow alum from the Berklee College of Music, a couple years older than me, and she was singing with Nancy Griffith at the time. And through a mutual teacher at Berklee, I had gotten hooked up with her, and she found me my apartment. So that was sort of the first thing that happened. And then things just kept rolling along. I don't know, Dave, do you want to?
Well, I feel like, you know, there was a very strong pull to Nashville, you know, for both of us. And it had to do both with, you know, it being sort of the focal point of a lot of what was at the time very old music that we liked, you know, even though a lot of the, what I'm going to call old time or string band music, brother team music, had really developed more around sort of, you know, Bristol, Tennessee, or, you know, sort of more that part, Eastern Tennessee.
Over in East Tennessee, yeah.
It had eventually over time, you know, sort of migrated a little bit to Knoxville, and then Nashville had become, you know, Country Music USA, and there was a lot of the sort of more what you think of as country music had all come out of there, and we both loved that music.
I mean, that's why we were playing as a duet. You know, that's why Dave and I were playing together, was because of all this old-time country and brother team music of the, you know, 20s, 30s, and 40s. So it didn't really matter to us that it was the 90s. You know, we were going to go to Nashville.
And, you know, I don't know if there would have been as strong a pull if it hadn't been for something that had been happening through, I'm going to say, the mid-80s to the late 80s in Nashville, where there had been something they were sort of calling the New Traditionalist Movement. And there were artists that we had heard, some on the radio, some not, but people like, you know, Steve Earle and, say, Randy Travis and
Mary Chavin Carpenter was in there.
Yeah, and I mean, we knew that Townes Van Zandt, who I had discovered not that long before then, was living there, Guy Clark. You know, Emmy Lou was there. There were just, it was a vital scene. And some of the sort of, you know, the best bluegrass that was still happening was coming out of, I mean, the Nashville Bluegrass Band was there. Tim O'Brien. There were a lot of musicians that we knew and respected. And so it made perfect sense to go and try to cast our lot there. I couldn't have put a list together in either of the other music centers or any other, you know, town in America that would have been, you know, a tenth as large for, you know, for us and our personal taste, I guess.
Now, Gil, when you said you were going there to be a songwriter, did you think you were writing, who were you writing songs for? Were you writing them for yourselves, or were you writing them for the, you know, the, what we see as the country music industry, or were you writing for people like you just named? I mean,
well, I don't think I really knew, quite honestly, but I didn't have a record deal. So from the just sort of factual point of view, I was writing for other people in a way. There was certainly some degree of neutrality in what I was doing because I wasn't sure it was going to be me singing the songs. And at the very beginning, that is what happened. Some of these people that Dave just mentioned, Tim O'Brien, Molly O'Brien, Emmy Lou Harris, these Nashville Bluegrass Band, these were some of our first cuts of people, you know, recording songs of ours. And that happened before we ever made a record. So that was the truth of it at the very beginning. People were doing our songs before we did them.
And in that case, we had started playing as a duet and playing out some around Nashville, but it was, you know, it was a time when I was playing with a lot of people as a guitar player, and Gil was, you know, writing songs by herself, and we were writing some songs together, and she was writing some songs with other people. We were both doing what you do when you move to a new town and you're young and just trying to figure it out and trying to make a living.
There were many writers' nights around town. You know, we were part of, you know, to a certain degree, you're always part of your freshman year class. You know, we had this whole group of people who moved to town around the same time we did, and we were all coming up together, you know, playing these writers' nights, playing everywhere we could.
And Nashville was a small enough town at the time, or felt that way, that you could see the path. It wasn't, you know, you knew that you had to try to get in at, you know, first these open mics where there were, that anyone could show up and sort of put their name on the list and get up and play a song. And then if you did well at them and someone heard you who liked you, you might get an invitation to play at, you know, a booked night at a very small club somewhere, you know. And we just sort of gradually started trying to make our way up through that.
I mean, we were very lucky. I feel like we always got a lot of support from the music community, from other writers, from other musicians and performers in town. You know, I think the first booked gigs, the kind of gig where your name would actually appear in the newspaper, we were usually invited into those nights by other writers. You know, I think one of our first writers in the round at Douglas Corner, we were invited in by Tony Arata, who wrote The Dance, you know, which was sort of setting Nashville aflame in the early 90s. It's a fantastic song that Garth Brooks cut. And I know some of our earliest gigs, I mean, we opened for Janis Ian. You know, she had gotten to know us, and she was a, you know, great supporter at the beginning. And I think one of our first out-of-town tours was opening for Guy Clark.
Yeah, and we opened for Towns a few times
opened
around
for towns,
Nashville.
Yeah.
And, you know, I mean, just to be near these people who had just been, you know, in some cases really, you know, names on a... I didn't know that Towns Van Zandt was alive because of his record called The Late Great Towns Van Zandt. You know, I assumed that was literal when I found that record. I was like, oh, that's too bad. I really like this guy. But yeah, it was... Well, I feel like I've drifted off topic. I'm sorry.
No, that's okay. Well, now here's a question. This might be a little hard to remember, but how do you think it is different now for somebody arriving there? That was 20 years ago. And I'm wondering what you see of it being different now.
I think it's still a songwriter town. you know, because that tradition is so well established there. I know that, you know, there's still a songwriting ladder you can climb that is in place at clubs like the Bluebird, you know. My impression is that the Nashville music scene has broadened at this point, which in a way sort of, you know, takes the monomaniacal focus off the country songwriter, which is kind of what the town was when we got there. But I think there are more opportunities to just play around town, and you don't necessarily have to, you know, be an acoustic guitar wielding songwriter now.
It's changed a lot in terms of, you know, how you feel about, you know, the genres of music that are there. Certainly, you know, East Nashville has evolved tremendously in the last 10 years, and people are just, you know, there's more people just coming there for music, as opposed to people coming because they're country music fans and they know that that's where they need to be. I think that that's a great thing. I mean, Nashville will always be a great place to live as a musician and work because the industry has taken hold there. There's great recording studios. There's, you know, publishers and record companies and all the things you need. But also, from a geographical standpoint, as a touring musician, it's, you know, pretty much in the middle of the country. I mean, you can get almost anywhere to tour in 12 hours. You can get up to New England, or you can get to Florida, you get into Texas, 16 hours will get you into Colorado, and get up Chicago, Minneapolis. I mean, other than the West Coast, you're pretty much in the center of the country, and it just makes it a great place for people who make their living going from town to town and playing at clubs or playing at stadiums. It's a great, you know, there's a reason why it really took hold there.
Do you feel the history of the city, the history of the city, the history of the music there, as a musician living there now? Is it, we've talked to people in other cities like, Memphis, and there's plenty of musicians in Memphis who don't have anything to do with R&B and with the blues. And I'm wondering if that's the case in Nashville.
I feel the history of Nashville, to a degree that I think it sometimes eclipses what is actually present in the current world. But, you know, that's what I'm looking for. Like, that's what brought me to the town, and that's what ties me to the town, is this really, really deep history of folk music and American music. So everywhere I go in town, everything I do, I see this, you know, other level of stuff that is either still there or just there as an echo. It's all over town. I mean, you know, the day that we went over to RCAB, which is a great recording studio that we, got to work in for a while. There was Bob Moore in there, one of the most recorded bass players of all time, probably. And it's just, it's all over town. You can't turn around and without, you know, bumping into it. I love that. I love that I'm very aware of whatever you want to call them, my heroes, as I go about my day-to-day life, you know.
I think sort of to talk to your other point, talking about, you know, different genres and things, it are musicians who aren't necessarily connected to country music but are working there. That has, I mean, I guess we've said it a few times already, it really has changed. Nashville has changed in that way. I mean, I just a month ago, I went to visit Dan Auerbach from, you know, the Black Keys at the lovely studio he's built. He was working, producing a band. They were a group of kids. It was this fantastic sort of guitar player and vocal group. I'm trying to remember.
Were they Nigerian?
Yeah, I think they were a Nigerian band. And great to see that happening in Nashville. And I know that that's sort of been the norm over the past, you know, decade, which I don't know that it really was the decade before that. So,
but then there's the whole history of Nashville, you know, that I've become more aware of since we, bought our studio, which we have had for 10 years now, Woodland Sound Studios, and it had a history. It actually was very important in the, it was the home of Nashboro Records, which was the gospel arm of Apollo Records, and there was a lot of Southern gospel and Black gospel recording done there, and it's so interesting because it's not unusual for us to be working at the studio and someone to come by and just knock on the door and, you know, say, just wanted to see the place, and they had worked there, you know, back in the 60s or in the 70s, and just from that one little thing, I've become much more, you know, educated in Nashville's R&B and gospel history, because, you know, the first stuff I knew about was string band and, you know, more stuff that came out of the Carter family tradition.
Have you had moments as a musician, nights or sessions, or I don't even know what it would be, that you think could only have happened in Nashville, that this is something that this city made possible because of the conglomeration of people that were there, or whatever it was? Any stories about that?
I don't know. There are so many moments. The first one that comes to mind is right before our first record came out, and which, funnily enough, is almost when we were most deeply entrenched in the Nashville songwriter circles. Because then, of course, as soon as you put out a record and you start touring, you start leaving town more and more. So when we were simply songwriters and were living in Nashville, right before our record came out, we were playing shows with Guy Clark and Townes Van Zandt. And, of course, we were the young kids opening the shows, but they were super, super nice to us. And there was this one night where the bill was, Dave, was it just you and me and Towns and Guy on the bill that night out at Green's?
Well, there might have been someone else. But
might have been somebody else too, but we ended up, we played this show, and the show was good, but what was remarkable was what happened after the show. Is, you know, in true Nashville fashion, you know, Doug Dillard had been there at the show also, which is very true in Nashville. You got to be real careful. You know, you can't take any show for granted because you never know who could be out there watching you. All kinds of luminaries. But we ended up back at Doug Dillard's house, and it was just a very late, long evening of carousing and song. And I almost can't even remember it. It was like this blur of, I can't believe this is happening. It had a very strange dreamlike quality, for one thing, because Doug's house was way out in the country and there were no lights anywhere. I just remember it was so dark trying to stumble into his house. And then we got in there and, you know, Towns was kind of in and out of the socializing. He would sit very quietly for a while and then he would sort of rejoin the party.
Something that came to mind a couple years before that, truly it was something that only could happen in Nashville. we had gotten some sort of a, we'd gotten a gig somehow. I don't remember how we got this gig, but it was going to pay somewhere between $100 and $200, which meant it was, you know, maybe the best paying gig we'd ever had. And we were supposed to play at the mall, the Green Hills Mall, and it was around Christmas time, and I guess every weekend they were having different genres of music, you know, come out and play sort of, and, you know, you got your stores on the any side, it's like an indoor mall, and then there was like a little stage that they had set up and, you know, somewhere in the mall, and you're supposed to play. And I guess they had booked us, I think, because there were only two of us, but they thought we could represent bluegrass, and so they probably didn't have to pay us as much as they would have paid a full bluegrass band. So we go down to the mall, and we're playing, and, you know, we've got our sort of sharecropper songs. We're playing these, like, Hide Your Money in the Mattress sort of songs, and we're supposed to be spurring people on to greater holiday purchases, but... You know, the store people started sort of closing their glass doors.
They truly were closing their doors because our music was too dour. Yeah.
But so we're up there and we're playing along. And one of the songs that we used to like to sing, in fact, maybe the first song that Gillian and I had ever sung together as a duet, was this great song that Lefty Frizzell recorded called "Long Black Veil," and I think at the time I thought it was a traditional song, but we did our duet version of "Long Black Veil," and yeah, there were a bunch of folding chairs out, and I think there might have been three or four people listening to us. And I saw in the background this diminutive woman with a shopping bag in each hand, who sort of stopped and had been listening to us for a minute, and then we were singing "Long Black Veil," and I could see her mouth moving, her lips moving. She was singing along, and I thought, well, isn't that great? That woman over there, she knows "Long Black Veil." Well, that makes me really happy that we're singing it. So we get done our little show. It was towards the end of the show. We play a couple more songs, and she stays and maybe takes a seat and listens. And we get done with packing up our guitars, and all of a sudden I look up, and here she is standing by us. And she says, "I really liked your show. I think you guys play and sing great." And we said, "Thank you." He said, "I love the way you did the Long Black Veil." And we said, "You know, thanks so much. We love that song." And she said, "I wrote it." And it was Mary John Wilkins, who with Danny Dill had written "Long Black Veil." And she very sweetly told us it was one of her favorite versions she'd ever heard of the song. And you know, then we ended up staying in touch with her, and she sent us some... What was it? A gospel song of hers that she wanted us to record. But that is the thing that happens, that, you know, yeah, that's a very Nashville thing.
This is what I mean. You never know who's out there, you know, sitting in one of the folding chairs at any gig in Nashville. You just never know.
Well, here's a question. I don't know idea if this is true. Are there any songs of yours that were particularly inspired by being in Nashville?
The first answer that comes to mind is the whole, our whole kind of third record, the Times the Revelator record. In a funny way, I think that was, even though at that moment that was our least traditional record we had made, the first two being sort of more obviously traditional, I feel like the Revelator record was the most about Nashville, and just those songs came about driving around and walking around the streets, the empty streets of Nashville, at, you know, 2-3 in the morning. That was a very nocturnal time in our lives. We're both sort of inclined towards being nocturnal anyway. And that was a very, very nocturnal time because we were recording in our house, which was an old caretaker cabin back behind a larger house. And it had no insulation. And so you could hear the planes going overhead. And so we could only record when the Nashville airport had no more flights, which was between about 12:30 a.m. and about 6 a.m. So that's when we were up working. So I don't know, that whole record, somehow Nashville as a whole existential being had really seeped into our thoughts and our vocabulary and everything at that point.
And right around then, it was interesting. I think about this sort of song that closes that record, which is called I Dream a Highway, which is a very long, it's, I don't know, 14, 15 minute long song, and it's filled with, you know, there's a storyline to it, but it's very...
impressionistic?
Yeah, it's a pretty impressionistic song, but the very first line of that song, it starts, John, he's kicking out the footlights, and, you know, that was initially, it was sort of, that image came from the sort of famous story of Johnny Cash being kicked off the
Getting
Grand
Ole
Opry.
Getting kicked off the Opry, yeah.
And breaking the footlights. I guess they put that in the movie.
Did they?
I don't know.
Okay.
I think they
Never
did,
mind.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And how do I explain this? That is sort of where that thought had started. And it ended up being the first verse of the song. But at that same time, we'd been hanging around a lot and playing music with John Hartford. And John had been, you know, had been ill for a while. And we had been seeing, you know, we'd been going out to his house on the Harpeth River and playing music. And then later on, when he was too ill, people would go out and sort of play music around him and talk. And I don't know, I guess at that point we had been in Nashville long enough that to see all of these musicians in this community all sort of come together
kind
around
of rally
him
around. Yeah.
Was just an amazing, yeah, it was an amazing moment, and it changed the shape of that whole song, and that whole performance ended up sort of, I don't know, sort of being focused around John and his, I don't know, and his spirit and the way, you know, I'd always really admired him in the way that he, you know, music was the most important thing to him for, you know, every day.
So going back to Time of the Revelator, the images for in the Red Eye Zone are from Nashville.
Yeah, and I can tell you that was Church Street.
Yeah,
that was Church Street about 2 a.m.
Yeah, and it was odd how all that stuff got to combine. You know, all these images and feelings about Nashville at that time were also combining with this, like, feelings of isolation and just the feelings of also, we'd done quite a lot of work on the road by then.
Yeah.
And there was this, you know, there were these two kinds of solitary experience or aloneness that were going on at the same time. We'd be out on the road, which was one sort of very solitary experience where, you know, just the two of us sort of out there going from town to town and playing these strange little gigs and seeing other people's strange little gigs. And I really feel the push and pull of, we would be out of the road, as I said, isolated, and then we'd get back to Nashville and we'd be isolated because we were up all night.
Yeah.
It was sort of...
Well, and yeah, I have such vivid memories of, you know, as Dave said, the road is an isolating, sort of alienating place for us. For one thing, it's, you know, you travel around, and particularly back a number of years, you know, we just end up feeling like freaks and outsiders kind of everywhere we go. You know, night after night when you show up at a club and they say, here's where you plug in, and we say, we don't plug in, and they say, no, here's where you plug your guitar in, it's like, no, they don't plug in. These things over time, you know, when you go through this day after day, I recognize that we've become very comfortable now feeling like outsiders, and You know, one of the interesting things, when I moved to Nashville, I recognized part of what was so comfortable about it for me is I felt like a bit of an outsider. I don't think I feel too comfortable when I'm supposed to fit in. I feel better when I recognize that I'm not supposed to fit in. And this appears in our work. You know, it's related to what we do. I find it interesting that our two records that I feel are most, where Nashville and Tennessee are the greater part of the content, these two records being the Revelator record and then the most recent record, The Harrow and the Harvest, we had to, at some point, leave Nashville, you know, and get out of it to actually write about it and then come back. You know, this is, and I think this is common with artists.
You made me think, one of the great feelings, something that I thought, you know, this may be true in other cities, but I know that it was true in Nashville and I appreciated it so much. When we arrived there, how to explain it, we were so accepted by musicians who just wanted to know if, you know, if they liked your playing and your singing, you were, the doors would open for you. You know, it wasn't about where you were from, and it wasn't about, people were mostly interested in just plain old good music, and that, it really allowed us to focus on the music that we would have focused on anyway. I mean, it was what we loved and it was what we were doing, but to get there and to feel in some ways, you know, accepted as, I don't know how to explain it. It was almost, I would say, accepted as outsiders.
Yeah. It's one of the most sort of, it makes me very optimistic what the tenor of our time and our life in Nashville. It's a great lesson to me in acceptance and tolerance and all kinds of things. It's, to me, it's sort of what's supposed to happen, which is you go somewhere, you're driven somewhere by your art and your ambition and your desires, and then simply because of what you do and your work and your sort of, I don't know what to say, I want to say like honesty, but, you know, just because of what you do, people get to know you and accept you just for what you do. And that's kind of been the history of our time in Nashville.
Okay, here's the opposite side of the coin, because we've got plenty of what's your favorite part about living there.
I know what you're going to ask.
Is there anything you don't like about living in Nashville? Any drawbacks?
Well, when we moved there, if you didn't like Southern cooking, you were out of luck. The food situation was a bit tough at times, but that has really changed. I know that sounds like a flip answer, but when you live somewhere, you know, food's pretty important. This is just a basic thing, but Nashville has really come a long, long way on the culinary front.
You know, I had to say, when you know, there's always been, there's two sides to every coin, and Nashville, when we moved there, it used to infuriate me because there seemed to be very little, there just wasn't a lot of preservation happening. You know, they had sort of torn down the governor's mansion and put up a Popeye's chicken. Like, this was the sort of stuff that
literally
was, that was happening in Nashville. There were a lot of, the history was, you know, in a few select places it was protected, but it seemed to be, there seemed to be a real just push towards what people considered progress. It wanted to be sort of a modern city, and it wanted to be a modern city as quick as it could be. And
Nashville's always had a bit of like the younger brother syndrome. Like it wants to prove itself, you know.
And this, you know, for someone who had moved there because of an interest in the tradition of Nashville and sort of what Nashville was, that was always a little hard for me to swallow. It's a funny, but there's a flip side even to that, which was, you know, at the top of De Mumbry in one of the streets there, they used to have sort of all these little country gift shops, you know, like the Barbara Mandrell store and the Kenny Rogers.
And the George Jones store.
Yeah, they had these little tiny, like, places where you could go buy these artists' merchandise. And right up at the top of that row of things when we moved there was a little white building that they had built as Hank Williams' house that they had moved, you know, put on a flatbed truck and moved in from Franklin and sort of plopped there.
It was a bar. They used to do writers' nights. Dave and I played some writers' nights there. And
We found out recently that it was actually his garage that they had taken and moved in. But, you know, there's something I really like about the make-believe aspect of it all.
That's I actually love that story because in some way it tells some truth of Nashville, you know, that there is this deep love of their musical tradition, you know, enough to take Hank's garage and plop it at the top of the row.
And call it his house.
And call it his house. And put a bar in there, have it be a tourist attraction and a nightclub. And then at the same time, you know, now it's gone and there's a beautiful glass high rise there, you know.
Right.
I don't know. It's all things at once.
Yeah.
Do you have a favorite of the touristy of the Lower Broadway side of Nashville?
Yeah, I do have a favorite. Actually, I'm very fond of Robert's Western Wear, and whenever friends come to town and they want to go do something that is both a really good time and quintessentially Nashville, we go down to Robert's, which is a bona fide honky-tonk. It is a functioning honky-tonk, which means you can't go down there and observe. You know, it's not a tourist attraction. It's a honky-tonk, you know, which comes with certain responsibilities. You are part of what is great about Robert's the second you walk in there. And it's a wonderful mix of 60, 70-year-old couples who come out because they know they're going to hear the songs they love. And it's, you know, 20-year-old guys out for a wild weekend because they just got done with classes at Vanderbilt.
People from all over the world.
People from out of town. But, you know, I tell people, you know, especially my girlfriends when we go down there, if someone comes up to you and asks you to dance, the answer is yes. You know, this is not, you are not separate from this, you know? You're not an observer. Some cowboy comes up to you and asks you to dance, say yes, you know?
There is, yeah, Roberts is a great place, and it's a great place. It has, you know, there's always a band there, and the best bands get the slots in the weekend and everybody plays for tips. And if you're, you know, a great Telecaster picker from, you know, anywhere in this country and you've made yourself you made your way to Nashville and you go down and sit in these honky-tonks and, you know, someone will probably let you get up and play a song. And if you're great, you know, you can probably be in that band the next, you know, at some point. And, you know, so many people who have made their living in Nashville, that's the way they came up, you know? So for musicians, here's like a, in some ways, these people who are, so many talented people moved to Nashville who in their towns, they were, you know, you could go, this was my situation where I had been from. I was playing in country bands, and you made a pretty good living. I mean, you'd make whatever at the time, $60 a night or, you know, $100 on a good night. And then you get to Nashville and you can play as much as you want, but, you know, you're playing for tips because there's just so many musicians there. But it's just, you know, it's a real survival of the fittest thing. And when you look at the quality of players that still exist in Nashville, it works.
And to see exactly what Gillian Welch is talking about, you can see our video of Robert's Western Wear on our Sense of Place website at npr.org/senseofplace. Our thanks to Gillian Welch and David Rawlings, and a delightful look at their life in Nashville for our Sense of Place series on the World Cafe.